Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Let's talk. Talk.
Face to face, finding justice for my murdered twin brother. When his identical twin brother Simon was kicked to death, all Nick Dawson felt for the killers was hatred. Struggling in a world where his mirror image had vanished, he came to realise there was only one way to stop the torture. Is the subject of a fascinating, compelling, and a book that will make you think very hard indeed about justice. Delighted to say that I'm joined live on the line by Nick Dawson himself. Nick, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us this morning. Tell us a little bit about your brother, about Simon.
Yeah, Simon and I were identical twins. We grew up in a village in Cumbria, on the west coast, just on the edge of the Lake District. Born 10 minutes apart. We were very much, in the early days, very, very identical. We could tell us apart. Classic identical twins. Mum would always dress us the same, and teachers couldn't tell us apart. We could play little tricks. We were very much companions. Being a twin, if anyone listening knows, as a twin themselves, that you are your life companions. You protect each other. You've incredible empathy, and you talk the same, you look the same. In the early years, my mum would always dress us the same. We had a wonderful, idyllic childhood. Actually, we grew up in a very countryfied environment, let's say on the edge of the Western Lakes. And we spent most of our early childhood sort of camping on the edge of the lakes. We used to cycle and we used to play. We lived in a really massive house with huge garden, it was just a wonderful childhood.
So this is all idyllic and far from perhaps the sort of urban sprawl and the problems it might have until was it 1998, and then the unthinkable happens. Just explain, if you can, brief. I don't want to go into too forensic detail about it, but is this an accidental? What's the situation? And let's just start with the situation itself first, please.
Yeah, it was a massive shock to the family. It was a bank holiday weekend in 19. My brother and I, my brother Simon, I'm Nick, and we just turned 30. We just had our 30th birthday. And I was actually settled down. So we started to slowly diverge a little bit as twins. I was settled down. Simon was still a bit of a party animal, liked his nights out. Went out with his friends to a nightclub. The first time we'd been to this particular area. Wasn't familiar. He was staying at a friend's house. In the days where there's no mobile phones, so he lost contact with the people he was with that night. Came out alone from the nightclub. He got hopelessly lost because he was trying to find his way to a friend's house where he was going to spend the night.
And whereabouts was this, by the way? Is it in Cumbria? Is it in Cumbria? Is he where is he?
This is actually in where he lived at the time, which is on the Wirral,
right,
in Merseyside, close to a place called Bromborough. And he asked two young lads directions, naively, not thinking much of it. And these two young lads were probably not kind of people that you want to meet on a late dark night. They tricked him and they walked him into a park. They said, "We're going that way. We'll take you where you want to go." Simon, being Simon, probably quickly realised he probably made a mistake. And when they got him into the park, they attacked him, and they ended up stamping him on him. They beat him up very severely for whatever he had on him, it was robbery motivated initially. And during the course of the attack, that they were wanting to get his PIN number for his cash card. And they would actually stamp on him, knock him unconscious, bring him round. There was a pond in the park where they were attacking him, a fishing pond. And they did get Simon's PIN number, but then as they left Simon unconscious after attacking him very severely, they lifted him and threw him in the fishing pond, unconscious, and he drowned. So he was found the following morning by a man walking his dog. So Simon was murdered.
The shock, obviously, for the family is just devastating. I mean, this isn't a movie where you've got to build up to the situation. You're presumably just sitting at home and get a phone call, or your parents get a phone call. We talk about impacts that these things have on the family, but it must have been absolutely, absolutely world shattering for you.
It's horrific, really, and you don't. There's a whole range of different emotions. My dad called me up and he told me straight away. My dad had just been to the mortuary to identify Simon after he was reported missing that weekend. And yeah, I kind of describe it as almost floating above the space and looking down on this thick fog of chaos, horror, disbelief, pain, grief, anger, thinking, is this a living nightmare? You get together as a family. That there's police, there's journalists, there's neighbours wanting to help, and we all descended on my parents' house. My older brother and me, and we were both married. My brother and I were both married, or we were still both married, and just trying to make sense of it. And you don't eat or you don't sleep for several days because you're completely shocked. You're in despair. It's hard to describe.
It must be the range of emotions you go through, from despair to rage to grief to impotence because you should have been, to guilt. I mean, literally the whole spectrum, as it were.
Yeah, the what ifs, the questions, the whys. There were possibilities that Sam was going to see me that night, and because we'd been travelling up north, and it didn't happen. And you think of those sliding door moments when maybe he hadn't decided to go out that night or whatever. And then the questions of what happened, you don't really know. At this point, we didn't really know what happened. It was just that he'd been found beaten up and drowned. The police latched on very quickly that I was an identical twin. So it was quite a big thing for me to help. And that's what I ended up doing.
So when you say, how did you end up helping then in that case? And how quick were the perpetrators sort of before they were apprehended?
It was quite quick, actually. And that's why I always think as murder victims, we've been incredibly lucky because we had a very quick arrest. I mean, in essence, the police did the usual thing, just get it out there in the media. And the detective chief inspector in charge of our case was brilliant. He got me up there in front of the press. I did a television appeal on BBC. It was on Sky as well at the time. And we got it out in the papers. I actually then also did a reconstruction of the night. I put my brother's clothes on, put his shoes on. I don't know how I did it at the time, but we basically did the walk from the nightclub. We went into the nightclub the following week, trying to jog people's memories. It was all, trying to work out what Simon would have done, and we filmed me in Simon's clothes, with, trying to get people to recognise.
Presumably, there's a point where you just sort of bitterly shuts down and thinks, well, I want to do this because I want to bring Simon's killers to justice and find them. But afterwards, I know it's necessary, but that's to put on your siblings' clothes and reenact. That's in terms of sort of mental trauma you could suffer from, that is absolutely huge.
It is, and sometimes I think I'm still processing that trauma to this day. I think to myself, how did I do that at the time? And you know, I have a lot of PTSD relating to what happened, and it never goes away. You know, and I sometimes think I still suffer from doing that. But it was a complete desire to help, and you know, kind of adrenaline kicks in, and I would have done anything. But it had the desired effect. It had the desired effect. A lot of people saw it. Tongues started wagging, so to speak, in the community. People were pointing fingers at two lads who they knew were trouble. And what they'd done was they'd stolen £500 from Simon's account because they got this PIN number, and they gone out and bought a whole load of new sports gear. And that was a telltale sign for one of their friends that they'd come into this money. And then I think, you know, I'd heard that there'd been some conversations in a pub that were overheard. And in essence, you know, that the police, after 2 weeks, arrested these two lads. They actually arrested three lads in it, but they were quick released the third boy. And because there were boys that were 16 and 19, and that's what really shocked us. So that, you know, the two boys were arrested, or the two young men, and that they were quickly realised that they were the ones involved in the attack on Simon.
When you hear that, when you heard they'd been arrested, I mean, presumably, did the details of how old they were and who they were and the fact that they'd been, you know, buying, you know, their desire to, this opportune thing had not only taken your brother's life, but also they went and spent the money on, you know, sports gear. I mean, how do you sort of even process that in that case? Because I suppose it's happy. The world is full of cold cases of people never finding out who, what, and why. But at the same time, there must have been relief that there had been an arrest. But also, you must have, you know, literally wanted to sort of see them hanging from the nearest lamppost, basically, because that is the way that people perhaps sometimes think.
Yeah, absolutely. I think initially it's curiosity. Who are these people, you know, who to murder my brother? But yes, I quickly jumped into anger, and I scared myself because I'm not an angry person. I'm actually a very gentle person, and Simon was. But I did have a lot of anger and hatred towards these two. And you know, I talk about some of this in the book, where I talk about visualizing torturing them myself. You know, my dad always said, my dad used the expression, these two young lads tortured and executed his son. And that's, you know, it was a savage attack. They tricked him and they tortured him to death. And in fact, actually one of them, when he was arrested, was wearing Simon's watch. It was just, they were so young that they had no real understanding of what they'd done. In the enormity of what they'd done. To them, it was like we'd hit a lad, we'd got some money, and we'd gone home. And the fact that they killed him, you know, what were they? They were almost subhuman to me. They were completely removed from my life, from normality in terms of my definition, and. Then to learn that there were boys, 16 and 19, or young men, was shocking.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because we like to think that we're sensible, sort of sensitive human beings, you know, gentle, the whole thing. And then something like this comes out, and you just want vengeance, don't you? That's the thing. It's something at a guttural. It's something at a guttural level, Nick.
I think you're right. I think the human psyche is almost, you know, you do go through those thoughts, and you do think of revenge. Even though in reality myself, I never thought I would actually act out the revenge. You know, I dream of hurting them. You want to hurt them for that they've hurt you. You know, and the fact that they gave Simon no mercy, and I know from finding out later that Simon was crying, and he was begging them to stop hitting him and begging them to stop and just go. But they showed zero. It was evil. It was just, that's what I described as it. I described them as evil monsters.
When you,
and that's all they were.
When you, obviously, it came to a court case. Presumably, you sat in on the court case. You were there because for most of us, we will never be inside a court case because hopefully our words, you know, words will never connect with that. And so it's a very alien experience. You know, I've sat in enough court cases as a young reporter before, but you see a lot of people in there. It's a whole new, quite terrifying world. Even if you're not sort of, you know, standing in the dock or presenting a witness statement, it is an alien environment. Presumably, again, there was, you know, there would be your parents, you know, your other brother, your family. I mean, and then you're seeing this presumably would have been the first time you'd seen these two face to face.
Yeah.
What goes to your mind then, Nick?
Yeah, it was. I mean, we were always going to be there as a family. We attended all of they basically got tried a year later. At Liverpool Crown Court, both of them were tried together. They both pleaded not guilty, and so we were put through a murder trial. And I think the crux of the prosecution was whether they actually intended to kill Simon and whether they actually threw him and whether it was both of them that threw him in the pond. We went through, you know, for us, it's about seeing the two involved. You know, I mean, we'd never seen them before. And to see the two kids sitting in the dock who really just, you know, just immature children, if you like, that hadn't really fully understood the enormity of what they'd done. And they were, you know, I think they were in protection mode. So there was very much denial. Wasn't me, pointing the finger at each other. And, you know, it's bizarre because you sit next to we were sitting next to the parents of the two accused.
Yeah.
So you kind of like, you're the victim's family and then you're mixing with the offender's families. And so you don't know whether to look at them, whether to say anything to them. And I know it's quite emotional. At one point, the younger lad's mum came up to my mum and gave her a hug. And I think she was just ashamed of what was happening. But it is a strange situation. And yeah, you know,
How did your mother? Because it's not a Disney. It's not a Disney movie. I mean, how does your mother react when she gets hugged by, you know, some, you know, the mother, another mother?
She didn't know what to do. She didn't expect it. I think she just. My mum was in such trauma that she did take a hug. Crying.
Yeah. Let's. When the verdict gets read out, there's that moment, and I talk. That is a movie thing, isn't it? Because your heart rate goes to the bloody roof. You're stressed. Your adrenaline punches above its weight.
Yeah.
Were they found guilty on murder? Was it a manslaughter verdict in the end? Was it a guilt? Was it a murder verdict? And what is your immediate reaction then?
Yeah, it was guilty to murder for both of them. And we just went, I remember just going yes, and I sort of like. And then we were just so relieved when the foreman read out guilty to both, and very emotional at that time. Things were slightly different in those days in 1998. You weren't allowed as victims to read out any statements in court, whereas you do these days. But it was it was just a huge moment to say we've got the two people involved. They've been found guilty and send them to prison, you know, and that's it. And you kind of forget about them. In fact, I wrote a journal throughout the trial and I actually put down on that last day when they got found guilty, rot in hell, you know. Again, I'm not that kind of person, but I was so angry towards them. You know, rot in hell, I never want to see you again kind of thing. That was a sentiment at the time for me. Just let's try and get on with our lives.
So what? Why do you decide? What makes you rethink then? Because a lot of people, and I get, you know, and I've worked I've worked with people who've you know, been in this situation in terms of, being awaiting trial and whatever. And people say, a leopard can't change its spots. There's always, you know, throw away the key, all that sort of stuff. Lock them up, rot in hell, as you said. There are no victim statements. So this continues though for you, doesn't it? Because you end up going into prisons. You end up explaining to offenders what's the spark, as we say, that makes you have that moment that you know, I mean, it's a big ask, Nick, for you to go back and face this, these situations again. What's the thing that makes you want to go back and try and understand and try and reevaluate?
Well, we obviously try and move on with our lives, and but it's not, you know, there's a massive gap, and I never say you never ever get closure, and people talk about closure. In a situation like this, you never get closure. For me, it's about learning to live with it, and I've spent my life trying to find meaning around what's happened. After about 14 years, they did start to go through the release process. You know, it happens, and they start to temporal hearings. And so the big defining moment for me was being invited to speak at their parole hearings, because it had come in quite new at the time, where you'd go to the prison and you were invited to go and speak at their parole hearings, and you'd be able to read out a victim impact statement to the offender and to the parole board. So that was something that we started in 2012. And when I went to my first parole hearing for the older offender, it was an incredibly emotional experience, because I saw somebody who I originally seen as a child, effectively, or a young adult. And he was a very emotional, from what I could see, because there's no dialogue, he's not allowed to say anything, but I saw a very emotional young man, or grown-up man at that point. And the same for the other offender. We went to his prison a year or two later, same response, a very emotional, someone who looked quite ashamed, actually. And actually, to that meeting with that, it was the younger offender who I started a connection with. We eventually went into this process of something called restorative justice, which is a process which allows some dialogue and a meeting, potential meeting, or just connection between offender and victim. And it's a long, long process, and they do a lot of checking, and you think long and hard about what's the right thing to do. But the younger offender, we end up having a resource justice conference and a meeting together.
Do you think that, because they're not 16 and 19, and then 14 years later they're obviously men, as you said, and for you, is it do you think this was part of the process, because now they understood? I mean, they'd had 14 years to dwell on this, to where they were, because I've seen young men attend hearings, and they think they're in a rap video, and they think that they're going to get they're going to be sent down, it'll be all be cool, and then they'll walk off to their girlfriends, and then suddenly when the shock hits them, the reality of it is pretty devastating, because they're kids. I'm not saying that the murder of your brother is something to be treated lightly, but is this something that you were able to see, that these people, these men now realize the enormity, and it's not just Simon, it's the whole, everybody who knew him, your family, that it had absolutely devastated. And I mean that word absolutely how it comes from, because there's no coming back from that.
Yeah. Yes, I definitely saw a change in the offender. I mean, I'm both offenders, actually, but I only ended up meeting one of them. And I think it's the passage of time. Certainly for me, my anger had subsided. I'm still angry. That's nothing's ever going to take that away. But I particularly wanted a meeting because I wanted answers. I wanted, as strange as this sounds, I wanted to bring to life those last few minutes of my brother's life. I wanted to know, and that's part because I'm his identical twin. So, one of my big driving forces around meeting him was to get answers to that night. But then I also wanted to tell him how hurt I was, and that was a very important part of giving a victim a voice. And effectively, you remember, I've got Simon's voice in that moment. Simon, Simon speaks from within me, in some senses. And so it was about Simon, through me, having some discourse with this person who killed him.
When it came to actually writing the book, I mean, why did you decide to put it down on paper. And again, you've already been through this horrendous trauma that most of us, thank God, will never go through. And you've got to restoke those embers. Why, Nick? Why did you don't want to write it down?
The book is several reasons for the book. First and foremost, I've always wanted my story to help others. And that's, you know, as we talked earlier about, I do a lot of work in prisons, and I tell my story to groups of offenders in prison to try and help them understand the life journey of a victim of crime. And so the book is getting my story out there to help others. Secondly, it's a very cathartic process writing a book about what happened, I've found, and it's helped me in a therapeutic sense. It's helped me get it down. It's helped me fill in some gaps because I went away and found about a lot more about what happened on that night, especially when I talked to a lot of Simon's friends, which I hadn't done for many years. You know, and murder is one of those horrible words. If you've had a murder of a close person in your life, it's, you know, strange as it sounds, you actually feel quite ashamed when you talk about it and embarrassed. And I've always have done. And it's been a very secret part of my life. I, you know, it's not something you raise in the topic of conversation to anybody. In fact, in many cases, for many, many years, I pretended I wasn't a twin. And I always avoided conversations which, you know, if people... You just getting to know, they ask, have you got brothers and sisters? You know, and I was always nervous about saying that I had a twin. Mm. So the book was partly about getting the story out there so I'm not ashamed anymore. And it's been a big process for me in that sense. And then I didn't want the story to be forgotten. You know, I use this expression, I want the truth to be told. I lost my dad in 2023. Simon's long-term girlfriend died very prematurely in her 50s. The girl that was with Simon on the night, one of the girls, had died through cancer. And there was all these sort of like players in the story were had passed away. And I thought, well, I want to tell the story. And I don't want to hold out anymore. It's been 27 years. And we created something quite special, I think. And I'm really proud of having something that is like a legacy for Simon and the story.
The book is called Face to Face, Finding Justice for My Murdered Twin Brother. It's by Nick Dawson. You can order it. Via our own virtual bookstore, or even better, go down to your own independent bookseller and ask for the book. But you'll see a picture of it anyway on our virtual bookstore. Nick, if people want to follow you and find out more information about what you went through, where's the best place to find you?
I've got a Gmail address, which I put in the book. It's contactnickdawson@gmail.com. No spaces. contactnickdawson@gmail.com.
The book is called Face to Face. It's by Nick Dawson. Nick, it's been a pleasure to speak to you this morning.
Thank you, Giles.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.